actually exercises precaution in this regard. Okay.
And no difference between males and females.
Of course, there's no difference as long as this. If a person watches, whether man or woman, watches these movies, these partially naked movies. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just like regular American videos, movies,
yes.
Okay, or European movies, it's not permissible as an obligatory precaution to watch these movies. If there's no fear of falling into a sin and there's no such intention as driving pleasure, or there's no lustful intention, there's no problem in watching these movies.
Mm-hmm. What about real life? Like when you live in the West, you see even sometimes partially naked women walking around the streets.
Yes.
And what about that?
Of course, you as a citizen of that country, you have the right to walk in the roads. You cannot, you see, turn. You cannot actually keep your eyes shut.
Exactly. Unless you're going to run into another car,
yes,
or person
that,
and have an accident.
There's no problem in seeing these women walking in this. There's no problem in seeing these women with proper or improper clothing, as long as one does not look at them or stare at them or mm-hmm. gaze at them mm-hmm. with lustful intention. The ruling Grand Ayatollah Sistani issues is largely dependent on one's intention, and of course it depends on the intention, whether something is going to be haram or something is going to be halal. If your intention is to look at a woman walking in front of you or coming towards you with lustful intention, it's not permissible to look at her. But seeing her, there is no problem, because you have to see. You just as you see the cars, the traffic rolling, and the people walking, you can see women also walking. And if you have no lustful intention, there is no problem.
Mm-hmm, I see.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What if some couples are having trouble having intimacy with each other, you know? And sometimes they are even advised by psychologists, for example, to watch such movies, even with the element of the lust.
Mm.
Not because of the lust per se, but because they want to have an intimacy or an intercourse with each other in their marital life. So basically, some of these people are recommended or advised to watch such content movies, adult movies, you know?
You're right.
Yeah. Is it permissible for couples according to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Sistani?
Well, that's a very good question. Ayatollah Sistani says it's not permissible for a couple, whatever the excuse, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Even if the husband has problem having intimacy, or sexual intercourse with his wife, it's not a license for the husband to play this video before having sexual intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there should be other actually cure, or there should be some kind of treatment for this, and the couple should consult a specialist, an expert, for any medication or any treatment
right.
Okay, available. So it's not permissible for the couple to play such movies or to watch porn in order to in order for the husband to be sexually aroused and then have sexual intercourse. That's not permissible.
Oh, that's not permissible.
Sure.
I see. Sheikh, what about a scenario where there are trips or journeys involved on the part of the man? And we know that sometimes they have to go on business, people are working,
sure.
And then they'd like to travel abroad, for business. So if they somehow stay far away from each other, I mean, a husband and his wife, is it possible, does this give a kind of permissibility to the couple to see each other naked online, for example, in order to please each other in this scenario?
And that's also one of the most frequently asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it is permissible for a man and his wife to see each other naked online, provided that it is safe, and they are confident that the video is not going to be, let's say,
released
to other people or
yes.
seen by other people, or there is no such thing as cookies remaining in the computer or maybe on the laptop, allowing other people to see it. Okay,
mm-hmm. And so they have to make sure even within the video not to be recorded.
Of course. There should be an arrangement for that. The two parties should make sure that no one else is going to see their video.
Yes.
And in this case, it is permissible for the husband and his wife to see each other naked. But there's one thing that the two parties should know, and that is they cannot start touching their, for example, private parts to help the other party get sexually aroused.
Yes.
Okay, that's absolutely not permissible, because self-gratification, self-stimulation
mm-hmm.
is absolutely forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no matter what the pretext or what the excuse.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis. and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are discussing the 184th sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam in this book. And in this sermon, Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about the qualities of those who are pious. We reached one of those qualities, which is actually the quality of contentment, where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Tarahu qani'atan nafsu." You will see that his soul, as his heart, is in a state of contentment. And of course, this is a very wonderful quality of a pious person, that each person needs to achieve slowly and gradually, inshallah, if he wants to truly achieve the pinnacle of piety. We were discussing about some of the narrations that Imam Ali alayhi salam and other imams and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam have mentioned regarding the virtue of contentment. Of course, one of those narrations that I mentioned previously is this particular narration where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, is reported to have said, "Azra bi nafsihi man istash'ara at-tama," that one who has greed, who feels greedy, is one who has a weak character. His character has weakened, and therefore he needs to strengthen the quality of contentment.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, of course, there are many other narrations that are there. One of the other narrations that is there is where the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam have said, "Kafa bil qana'ati mulkan," that contentment is enough as a kingdom, is enough kingdom for someone. "Kafa bil qana'ati mulkan." What does this mean? This is quite a deep narration where Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to tell us that a person who is pious gets is able to own such a, you know, treasure that it is enough for him. He doesn't need anything after that. He's as if he's a king. Okay, he is. Because he has what he wants, right? Which is the perfection of coming closer to God. That is enough. That qana'a itself brings that contentment is actually that good thing that gives him that perfection that is required. Or for example, in another narration, we have that خيار المؤمنين القانع وشرارهم الطامع. He says that the best of the believers, if you want to know which believer is a good person, which believer is not good, he's bad, because a person can be a believer, but he may have some badness in him. So, because not all believers are completely good in all fields, isn't it? Well, if you want to see that character that is really bad for a believing person, it is when a believer is greedy. A greedy believer, he is very bad. While the best of believers is one who is content. Or, for example, in another narration, we have that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam have reportedly said, لا شرف أعلى من الإسلام. There is no nobility greater than that of being a Muslim. ولا عز أعز من التقوى. And there is no, greatness or honor bigger or greater than the honor of being pious. وَلَا مَعْقَلَ أَحْسَنَ مِنَ الْوَرَى. And of course, he goes on and goes on. Inshallah, we will continue this narration after the break.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So the Imam continues in the narration after saying, "La azza la azza azza min al-taqwa," that there is no honor greater than the honor of piety. And then he says, "La ma'qala ahsana min al-wara," there is no safe haven better than the safe haven of staying away from evil deeds completely, even from those that are doubtful. So that's a very good safe haven, because when you know that I will stay away even from that which is doubtful, when I doubt something is not good, I will stay away from that. وَلَا شَفِيعَ أَنْجَحَ مِنَ التَّوْبَةِ. And there is no intercessor more that can make you more successful than the intercession of repentance and asking for forgiveness. لا كنز أغنى من القناعة. There is no treasure which is richer than the treasure of contentment. So this was the actual place that I wanted to discuss about, that the one, the greatest of treasures, is that treasure of contentment. And as I mentioned before, why is it such a great treasure? It's because it is that thing that truly causes a person to become perfect. The perfection of a human becomes perfect. I mean, that is the thing that actually is that richness. What does richness help you? Richness is when you have something that is truly there, truly perfect, truly good. So beyond these perfections of the soul, the other material things are not of true intrinsic value unless they are at the service of the soul and the heart. And that is why we say that the person who has reached a level whereby he is happy with what he has materially, with the decisions of God in all senses, legislatively and ontologically, he has reached that state whereby he has that goodness that is required for him to become perfect, and therefore it is the richest of things. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من
القاسم أحمد والوحي ربا.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Dieter. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Shakhdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Shakhbakhna Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can, little by little, show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament.
Our people are waiting us to start writing the constitution.
They wrote one article of the constitution.
There is a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States, but you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embrace the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it was interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married, they have their first babies, they both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world: how do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution. And her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna,
who's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab.
She wants to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, mm-hmm. whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic, which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult, because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, Jawara, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it, because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hopeful for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community.
It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue, that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view where she talks a lot about, you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage and your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about, this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, rather than looks like a Western democracy. We need to understand that there are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it. But they come across the same issues where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issue attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issue. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was this...
Actually, we're going to touch on that a bit later on.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste. This harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like, watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman who is well supported by her Islamic, her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be who wants to be like Sweden or France, her husband, who has spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke. He goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, you know, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas yes, the others didn't.
Yes. I mean, it is actually a very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting, because she's, you know, she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to what she's saying, because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it, because people want to find their own way through democracy. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually find, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently, I mean, historically speaking, recently freed or independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamists tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR stunt, as you mentioned. But of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and a failed monarchy to, you know, to finally be a democracy. So I think we need to give it time. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state.
I think, yeah, we're going to discuss more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary. It was Emna who was supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what were some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces. Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. The personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than Jawahara.
Really?
But what is interesting as well, I knew very little, like nothing, about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator Ben Ali, was it?
Yeah.
He was a secularist. And when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So the points that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important, because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. And you know, in the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary. I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Jawahara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. And can you explain that?
Yes, I want to ask Catherine,
well,
actually. Could you give us
Well, women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, you know, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards, and which is why he was, you know, quite well liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. And the sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emna wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary where Jawahara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how they have to smash the terrorist stereotypes and work together. What did you make of that scene?
Well, I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that there was...
Both facing the Muslims and the secularists.
Yeah,
the
I mean...
Isn't just the Muslim problem?
Indeed. There is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film. Angelina says, this is awful. This is not what my father taught me. This is not what is in the Quran. We must fight it.
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital. It's in Bardo. It's in the museum, next to the parliament, and especially I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me, and this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. Then, okay, we have to fight them.
There was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? It's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, is another universal point that she's making there.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? So briefly there was an issue of terrorism.
Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off. And it's a blueprint, it's a compounding of everything. All the issues that, you know, other countries in the Middle East are facing right now, which is terrorism, you know, the discussion, secularism, Islamism, what do we do? Could we find, another way? I think her silence, speaks volume, really. And it's really moving, because what do you say in the face of, radicalism? What do you say before terrorism? Terrorism doesn't speak for any religion. So, here it's Islam, but, it could be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it doesn't matter. There is no religion that, preaches, violence. It's just ludicrous. It's a political construct. And I think that what you have here is a desire, is this attempt to have pluralism. Mm-hmm. And this is what I heard, throughout the documentary.
Acceptance and tolerance.
Yes, that people need to find a way to live together, to find a way to disagree, but not hate each other. You can hate each other's ideas. It doesn't mean you have to hate each other and enact on that hatred. And I think this is the main issue that you have, is that people have been taught, for whatever reason, that they live to live in this kind of binary construct where they have to be either, on this side or that side, hate each other or love each other. It doesn't have to be this way. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot has to do with the way that the revolution was spoken out in the media. That kind of imprinted this idea, again, that they have to be against each other. Clearly, those two women have very similar paths. Even like I said, they're sitting on different sides of the river. But again, they're facing the same challenges. They just approach them differently.
And Carol, would you agree, is there a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media?
I think there probably is. Of course, I'm not in a position to know what's false and what's not. But yes, Catherine is absolutely right when she says that we can live together with different viewpoints. I hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And that's what we need to actually get, not just in Tunisia and not just in the UK, but throughout the world.
And this is one of the most powerful messages you get from the documentary.
Yes, yes.
And so we're nearing the end of the film and this program now, and I'm just wondering, what would you have liked to have seen in the documentary also?
What would I... I would have liked a little bit more explanation of the context. I got a little bit confused. I was very aware there was a Democratic Islamic Party because Joël Ara was part of it. They were taking a heck of a long time over writing the constitution, somebody pointed out. A bit like Brexit, really. and then suddenly when the president, or was he the prime minister, I can't remember, decided to cede and say, okay, we'll have another election, suddenly the constitution was in place. I didn't realise how quickly that could be. So there were certain things about clarity which I would criticise.
Would you recommend the film, Final 30 Seconds to
Yes, I'd be very interested. It's American, I don't know where it's been shown in America. It's a sort of film that might crop up on BBC 4 or Channel 4 or something here. And I think it would be an interesting one for us all to watch.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Lecture. Sheikh Asad Ja'fari.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi alladhi la yablughu midhatuhu al-qa'ilun. ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتحدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفرقان ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد صلى على وعلى بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا قوا أنفسكم وأهليكم نارا صلوا على محمد وآل محمد Achieving a life of bliss through the Islamic family has been our ongoing topic. Our attempt has been to visit the issues that we have inside of our homes. And to understand the Islamic approach when it comes to the family system. You know that the attempt is to convert our houses into homes and to add light and nur, of course, to the family structure. It should be for us an avenue and a place of serenity and contentment. And sometimes it's not, to be very realistic with all of you, sometimes it's not a as I mentioned. And in light of the discussion on trying to convert your home into a maskan, we used the traditions and the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. They talked about seven principles of behavior and conduct with your family. And I promised you that here we will go through at a very, very basic level, of course. I don't have time to go deep into every single one. At least enough to trigger the thoughts inside of your homes of these seven principles. And I promise you by the end of my lectures, you'll have these seven, inshallah, memorized. The first two we discussed was forbearance and forgiveness. Hilm and af. The second two that we discussed yesterday was tawazur and sakhawat, humility and generosity. We discussed two more today. The last one, of course, is tomorrow. But the attempts, like I said, for us to apply these seven inside of our homes at various degrees. For example, you know, and I really appreciate feedback when I get it from all of you. Somebody had asked me that my talk on forgiveness, to what limit do you forgive somebody? If they keep wronging you and they keep oppressing you and they keep doing things that are against you, for example, and you keep forgiving them, is that not you, of course, being a doormat? And it's a great question. And if I had time, I'd expand on that in my discussion on forgiveness. But naturally, Islam does talk about the idea that, you know, you are not to be zalil in this world. A mu'min should be someone who has street smarts. That if somebody has wronged you, and they've come to you, and they have asked for your forgiveness, you forgive them, but you always protect yourself against people who have wronged you in the past. I'm not asking all of you to always be an object of somebody else's oppression and keep saying, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And they, of course, do dhulm and dhulm and dhulm. No, of course not. But where it is possible for you to soften the heart with forgiveness, then of course you forgive. In today's discussion, we move forward to principles number 5 and 6, and that being shafqat and nasihat. Compassion and giving advice and seeking advice inside of your homes. If I had time, I would recap yesterday's talk, but I don't have time. I realize that by the time I get into my actual content, I'm a good 10 minutes into my discussion, and 50 minutes isn't a long time at all. So, let's get started with the idea of compassion and advice. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The concept of compassion in Islam is a very beautiful one. And one that I really hope I'm able to deliver to all of you if you don't understand. To be compassionate to somebody is not the same as being forgiving towards somebody. Forgiving somebody is to overlook their faults. Compassionate is to empathize with the person in front of you. To place yourself in their shoes. To look at the situation through their eyes. For a moment to become 16, let's say, if you have a child that old. Or for a moment to look at it through the lens of your father or your mother. Compassion is the sunnah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And I'll get to the discussions in a moment. But it's important that in the beginning of tonight's lecture, I make a point to our children and our youth in the audience. I don't think sometimes we realize, and I've made this point to several communities, and I'll make it here as well. I don't think we realize, and when I say we, I mean children to immigrant families. I think that's the majority of us in this room. Born and raised in a different country, migrated, let's say, either here or somewhere else into the West, for us to have a better life. I don't think we as children ever realize how difficult that migration was. I don't think we've ever put ourselves in the shoes of our parents when they first arrived, let's say, however long you've arrived, wherever you settled, let's say in the 70s or 80s, and you built up, let's say, your status to what it is now. And a 15-year-old sees everything now, but does not know the journey the parents went through. I think sometimes it's important that you sit down your children and your child, and you tell them about your story. Tell them when you landed in Vancouver. Tell them what you had in your pockets. Tell them how you went, let's say, from a small little studio apartment to the house that you live in now. Tell them how you built your business. Tell them how you built your profession. Tell them the odd jobs that you did. I don't think any of us know that journey. You know, just a few months ago, I had stumbled across a story that my mom told me about when she flew from Karachi to Toronto with two of my siblings. And she described that flight, the first time that this woman is on a plane with two kids. She's 17, 18 years old, not a word of English, no idea what a plane is, of course. It's in the sky, and she's scared out of her mind, and she's clutching onto her two kids for a 12-hour flight. And then she would tell about how, you know, in one apartment, there's like 6, 7 of us, and then we broke off, and then, you know, we had to, like, save here, and we had to discount here, and it was amazing. And the reason why that's important for us to know as children is because, honestly, we would never be able to do what our parents did. And I think it's high time that we appreciate the fact that they were able to do what we weren't. They flew across an ocean We won't cross province lines sometimes. Right? If somebody asks you to settle, let's say, in Saskatoon, would you do it? If somebody asks you to go to Manitoba, let's say, and set up shop there, not only set up shop with your family, but be a pioneer in the Islamic community in, let's say, Winnipeg, in the 70s, in that cold. Sometimes moving, let's say, to a different city in the province, you have to think about it 10 times. And as one poet said it, these were parents that converted a suitcase into a house. And they did it by not knowing the language, not knowing the culture, working odd jobs, like I said, sometimes 7 days a week, sometimes two jobs at a time. All so that you and I could have a better life here. When we sometimes put ourselves in the shoes of our parents, then maybe a lot of what they ask us to do makes sense to us. Compassion is literally, like I said yesterday, to travel outside of you and to place yourself in the presence of somebody else. To look at the world through their lens. To look at the world through their experience. Because they have the himmat and the strength and the courage to do something, like I said, that I don't think my generation and younger could ever do. I mean, think about what they did. They were very comfortable in their homes. Back home. They had the language, they had the family, they had the life, they had everything. I mean, sometimes when my uncles talk about their life in the streets of Karachi, their face is glowing. Those were golden days. We were making money, we had the family, we had the culture, I knew the streets inside and out. Those were the good old days. You come here now, of course, and you deal with non-Muslims and non-Desis and this and that, and you have to learn the language, and on top of that, get ridiculed for your accent. All these things are there. But they never once considered going back. They fought through all of that so you could have a little bit of a better life. And now when a parent like that, after going through such a difficult process, sees a child make mistake after mistake, or not have a moment where he or she realizes how difficult it was for them to have this life, then naturally that's frustrating for a parent. So empathy and compassion are two very important tools inside of a home. On the other side, sometimes I wish my parents would look at this world through the lens of their 16-year-old son or their 19-year-old daughter. And how difficult it is to step foot out there in this day and age when not shaitan, but shayateen are attacking them from all walks of life and all corners, and for them to somehow uphold their deen, somehow fast in a month of Ramadan, somehow come here every night for the past 3-4 nights. It is more difficult than you growing up in your streets of Africa or India or Pakistan, with all due respect. It's different than when I grew up in Toronto. The stories I hear, the challenges I hear, the bullying, the difficulties of today's youth are enormous. My heart bleeds for them. The fact that I see sometimes individuals at that age could easily just give themselves up to the norms, fight that norm, and fight that shaitan, and fight that whispering, is worthy of our compassion. So yes, if they have off days, off weeks, if they're quiet, if they're a little bit frustrated, if they have no idea what to do, then maybe as a parent we should be a little bit patient with them and look at the world through their eyes. This two-way compassion inside the home is missing in today's day. The child doesn't see the world through the parent's lens, the parent doesn't see the world through the child's lens. And that's the problem. We want the person in front of us to look at things the way I look at things. That's not going to work. That's not how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala works. Think about the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will judge us, or how He gives us a risk, or how He forgives our mistakes. We all know, and you've heard it 1,000 times from the member, that His adala and His fairness is such that He'll look at the circumstances under which you are right now living and existing, and quote unquote judge you accordingly. He won't paint you with the same brush of a 16-year-old in the streets of Najaf or in Qom or under Islamic Republic. He knows that it's very difficult sometimes to pray Salat at work but somehow you manage to do will do inside the bathroom without someone walking and saying, why is this guy washing his arms? And finding a corner somewhere in the office and pray Salat quickly until someone says, you know, are you doing yoga? What were you doing exactly? And you do all of that with the hopes that maybe Allah will accept that prayer. He sees all of that. He sees the fact that a muhajjaba sister is out there wearing hijab, let's say, for example, and maybe being taunted, and maybe being ridiculed, maybe being bullied, let's say, for example, maybe being asked 1,000 questions. And for that brief moment, she is the ambassador of the entire religion. It's heavy for a 15-year-old. It's a lot for a 17-year-old. Allah sees that. And his judgment and his questioning and his risk and his forgiveness is all based on what? It's almost as if, come with me for a moment. Metaphorically, he's almost putting himself in the person's shoes. And saying, look, to uphold your religion in Vancouver and to uphold your deen, let's say, in Najaf, in Karbala, in Qom, in Mashhad, are two different avenues. He's not that unfair, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So his empathy, his compassion is literally, he sees the person's life through their lens. He knows that you were raised in a single parent home, for example. He knows that you were raised an hour away from the center. He knows that maybe your family couldn't afford, let's say, an Islamic school, for example. He's seen all of this. And he judges you accordingly. And he gives you accordingly. And he forgives you accordingly. And I've said it many times that everything that every individual in this room goes through is according to their personal capacity. Does not spray everybody with the exact same spray. He doesn't. If there are 7 billion creations in this world, there are 7 billion different paths in this world. And he gives according to your capacity, to your qadr, to your strength, to whatever you can handle. Does not give anything else beyond that. Meaning what? He's compassionate towards your state right now. He's putting himself in your shoes and seeing the world through your lens. Understand this kid has had a rough childhood. And the fact that he's grown up without proper parents, let's say, for example. Or the fact that he's been raised or she's been raised in a home that is not quote-unquote pious. And for her to come out as a muhajjaba sister or him to come out as a student of the Hawza is incredible. And he sees all of it. It's high time that we become a little bit more compassionate towards others. Inside of our homes now. Forget anywhere else. Inside of our homes. Our 5-man home right now. You know, ask yourself, if I was 16, going to school, having to deal with everything. Look, imagine a 21 and a 22-year-old today. Okay? And I know you've all been through it, and so, but they're a little bit different now. A 22-year-old at that tender age has a number of things to think about that will affect the rest of his life or the rest of her life. Everything from what major to take in school, everything from who to marry, for example. She has no idea, he has no idea where he'll end up, for example. All that within the first few years of being 20. So not only is she trying to build her career, let's say, or get educated, or find a proper major that has an actual market in the BC province, but now, of course, her parents are on the case about getting married. And showing her picture after picture. What about this guy? What about this guy? What about this guy? And she's trying to make sure that she aces her exam, and she goes to work in the evening, and that she considers this guy to be her life partner, let's say. All of that, let's say, in the span of a week or 2 weeks. It's daunting. It's a lot. And sometimes my parents forget the fact, the stress that they went through when they were in their 20s. But on the flip side, I'll say it 3 or 4 times again. Not only did our parents come and migrate here and get their jobs and find their homes, they established these four walls. In my generation, we're